I'm Steve Bijou, and this is Down Home Corner. Are you like I am, from Canada's East Coast and proud of your roots? Well, then just like me, you're a down-homer, and we are all connected. On this episode, we connect to Dallas-Fort Worth and speak with Windsor, Nova Scotia native John Paris Jr., hockey's first black professional coach and author of the book, They Called Me Chocolate Rocket. Then, back to Nova Scotia for a chat with Ed Saunders of the Saunders Brothers Show. Welcome to the show. And what a show. John Paris Jr., a well-respected hockey mind, and Ed Saunders, a wild, creative, talented musical mind. I don't mind telling you our website is up, downhomecorner.com. That's where you can find our latest podcast and past shows, so you never have to miss any episodes. And you can go back and listen again to your favorites or recommend them to your friends. As always, feel free to please share our episodes on social media like Facebook. It helps us connect even further. Also, if you're a down-home business or if you have a unique product or service available through the internet or mail order, you might consider being a sponsor on our show. Just go to our contact page at downhomecorner.com. If you need a professional voice for your business or an upcoming project, I have decades of experience. Just click on Steve Speaks to hear my audition. Anyway, let's get to the show. Let's get right to her. I'm proud to be black, but even if I wasn't, it wouldn't matter. Nature made the call. When I began, a black man in hockey was a novelty. Of the six teams in the NHL in the 1960s, none had a black player on its roster. That fact alone prepared me for a bumpy road ahead. I've tried to never let race factor in my hockey life, although, when others made it an issue, I had little choice but to respond. Those words from John Paris Jr.'s book, They Called Me Chocolate Rocket. John is from Windsor, Nova Scotia, Curry's Corner to be exact. Being black didn't stop John from playing hockey or nearly making the NHL at a time when no blacks played in the National Hockey League. Chances are, were it not for health problems derailing his playing career, he might have made it. Instead, John became the first black professional hockey coach and led the Atlanta Knights of the International Hockey League to their first championship. Along the way, it included a stint in Campbellton as coach and GM of the Restigouche Tigers. Two major events took place there in Campbellton. John suffered a major heart attack, and on the happier side, he got married there. Like many other down-homers, his journey has had its share of ups and downs. But then again, adversity is not something a good down-homer will let stop him. John now lives with his wife and family in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. Well, John Paris, welcome to Down Home Corner. Thank you so much for being here.
My pleasure, Steve. My pleasure.
John, after all these years, I mean, you have lived away from the Maritimes more years than you've lived there now, if you look at it. Is there still a part of you that you would consider a down-homer?
Well, once a Maritimer, always a Maritimer. Born in Windsor, Nova Scotia, that's home, and it'll always be home. I have friends still back there from my youth, et cetera. And I go back as much as I can. My sister, the home, the land where I was born is still there. And a lot of the people that I've known are there. Plus, when we travel around the world, we meet a lot of people from Nova Scotia. There's a friendly atmosphere that will never change. For Scotians are Scotians. Maritimers are Maritimers. Nova Scotia, New Brunswick, Prince Edward Island, Newfoundland, if we go that far over on the island. It's all great. That's great people. It's known for its hospitality, and a lot of people return there when they retire.
So what do you think a down-homer is? How would you describe a down-homer?
Just a down-to-earth person, somebody that loves life within reasonability, things like that. Somebody that's very open to others, helpful, empathy. They're very, very, very down-to-earth people. Again, without repeating myself, and you'll know a down-homer when you meet them, just simply by the way that they will bring themselves to you, the way they'll talk, the way they will act. They'll make you feel comfortable.
Very nice description. I like that. Now, you were born in Windsor, Nova Scotia, like you said, where many consider the birthplace of hockey. You grew up in Curry's Corner. What was life like back then when you were a kid? What do you remember about those days?
Well, it was completely different than today. I live in the United States of America, so actually it's a little a little different. The safety value is not there like it was when I was growing up in Windsor. Curry's Corner, you knew everybody. Every door was open. Everybody was like a mother or a father. You didn't need to have a police or anything like that for your parents to know where you were, what you were doing. They'd know before you were home if you did something, whether it was good or bad. What also was very interesting, nobody went hungry there. If you were out playing with the other kids, well, the families, if they fed their child, they fed you too, and the same as my parents did with others. So that's just the way it was. It was just like one huge family. There was no racism per se, like we see that's kind of creeping within to the values of some of the people today that you'll see elsewhere. Windsor, we just didn't have that. I was just one of the boys, one of the others. We were the only family, black family in the town limits at that time. So in our family had owned their home, since 1854, but had been there since 1794, 95. So we were one of the first. But a great place to live. Most people that were born there would die there, and it went on for generations. The only reason why a lot of people leave was for work or academic reasons. We're off to university, and it wasn't much work. It was more of a little bourgeois town about 45, 50 minutes from Halifax with the new highway that they have now.
Now, you speak very highly of both your mother and father in the book, and it's obvious that you had an enormous amount of respect and love for both of them. You credit them as a big influence on your career. Family life and grounding, it's important for an athlete in your eyes, isn't it?
Very important. And you'll know the most successful athletes, I call it the kitchen table effect or effect, where the discussions, the lectures, as we would call them, our mother would set us at the table, and we'd have that discussion every week, the way you act, about morals, ethics, the responsibility that you had toward others and towards yourself, towards your family. You did not bring your family name down. You did not have that right. You were allowed to keep it the same as it was or improve it. You could not bring anything negative to it. The importance of academic education, just simply how you carry yourself. That's something that was what I call it, college credits. Wayne Simmons has that of the Philadelphia Flyers.
And we'll talk about him in a bit, too, because you've got a great story about him. But I remember that Facebook post that you're referring to. I was calling it the mom factor. You know, you referred to a lot of what you learned in your career and the lessons you applied were because of conversations between you and your mother.
Most of it. Yeah, mom was not, she didn't have a college education. She had to leave school young and take care of her sisters. Her mother passed away when my grandmother passed away. My mother was young. I never had the opportunity to meet her. And I do not remember my grandfather because he died in 1948 and I was only two. But my mother would sit down and explain. She was a psychologist, like a lot of moms were back in those days. Well, the moms stayed home. There were more moms that were not working. There were very few working moms back then in the 50s and late 40s. So most of them stayed home. Some not by choice, some by choice. Hers was by choice, and that's what she wanted to do. She wanted to be home and take care of the family, as she would put it. She handled the household duties, et cetera. And my dad went to work and took care of the financial issues. So. But she was the one who would have the meetings with us mainly. My dad, he was the one who made sure that we had the opportunity to play sports or to attend different, let's say, academic events, whether it be scientific events or geography, et cetera. So we had opportunity that was presented to us by our parents, and it was up to us to grasp the importance of it and to utilize it in the proper way.
Now, your father was a World War II veteran, and he also, for a while, ran a laundry business. And as you say, it folded, which I thought was a cute little term that you used. But you learned a lot of your values, obviously, from him and you know, work ethic and that kind of thing. But I remember a story about Walter Gretzky and Wayne. And the story was that when Wayne was younger, they used to watch games together. And they would analyze games. And he had given Wayne one of those foolscap tablets, you know, and he had drawn a rink on it. And he said, watch the game and follow with a pen where the puck is the entire game. And he said, at the end of the game, they'd look to see where the puck was mostly. And then they learned things from that. Now, you had a similar relationship with your father in analyzing games when you were a kid.
Yes, that was a way of staying up, too, at the same time. My dad used to, he would advise me before the game, no, I want you to watch the game. And he would make certain block point notes. I had to break down the game with him during the game between periods. At that time, sometimes the game would start at the middle of the first period or at the end. I would break that down. At the end of the game, then we would have a replay. And during that replay of the game, he would ask me questions. I would have to explain it. And as I grew older, I would start using the pad. We'd have a large pad, and I would have a diagram of an ice surface already prepared on it. We had three or four of those huge pads out there. But that's what we did. You studied the game, and it became a passion for me because he turned it into a game within a game. I was supposed to try to win the game by defeating him with the knowledge that I acquired from watching the game. He and I would play like a chess game with it. And it just became a game within a game. And that's how I learned more about the game. The apprenticeship of the hockey at that time gave me an advantage over many because there were so many things that I was mentally prepared for. So, and my dad helped with that. And the physicality side of it, well, my dad, of course, he had his outdoors or in the living room. My mom would get upset at times. But like most of the athletes, that's what we did. The living room was the living room, the basement, the backyard. Those were the ice arenas or the ballpark.
That's invaluable information and you know, helped you to become a student of the game at a very young age. But you wonder, like, where did the genius, you know, come from, you know, your father and Walter Gretzky to know stuff like that? You know, nobody taught them that.
No, that was not taught. I believe that was innate, but what happened? Remember, there was no, before we came along, there was no television. So our parents, my dad, he listened to games in the radio when he was young. And a lot, even then, there were baseball games, hockey games that he would listen to on the radio because the hockey came on at that time, Saturday evening and Wednesday evening. The rest of the time, if he wanted to listen to a game, it had to be via the radio. So probably just from sitting there, imagining the game, using energy, et cetera, that's probably what brought that about. Plus, he was an outstanding athlete himself. Outstanding. He was an excellent hockey player. Outstanding baseball player. One of the best in the country. So as far as that goes, he probably with all of that and practicing, they had a lot of time. Don't forget, they had a lot of time to practice. It's not like today where you have to travel maybe miles and miles to get to school. I mean, all he had to do was just, he could walk to school back and forth. There wasn't a lot of things to do. The automation is not like it is today. So I believe Wayne Gretzky's father and my father, and I'm not comparing myself to Wayne Gretzky, far from it, as a player, but on the knowledge side of the game, I will do that though.
You're listening to Down Home Corner. Down Homers, we're all connected. Remember to visit our website, downhomecorner.com. Hear our latest shows and past podcasts too. To find out more about being a sponsor on the show, leave your info on our contact page. Now, back to our show with John Paris Jr., author of the book, They Called Me Chocolate Rocket. Fascinating book, fascinating life.
Montreal Canadiens signed me as a junior, and that's how I left Windsor and went to school in Montreal. The Montreal Canadiens brought me there. I was signed by Scotty Bowman was their head scout at the time, but I had four of the six NHL teams came. They were all by letters. The fifth one was the Montreal. They sent someone to the house, which was Bowman. So I had a choice of five of the six teams at the time to sign with and go to camp. So that's how that all happened. And I played the first year between the Junior Canadians and Maisonneuve in Junior A. So that's the start.
Well, I can imagine how proud your father must have been when Scotty Bowman shows up at your door.
Yes, well, the Scotty Bowman, Montreal Canadiens, Montreal, Toronto, Boston were the teams in Windsor. That's what everyone would talk about. So Montreal was, I would say, the Canadian team number one, and then Toronto number two, Boston would be number three, and the choices of the families or the fans. But when, Scotty Bowman, when he showed up, I had to go home and leave school and go home to meet him. He came there twice. And the second time I was down at the ballpark. So it was quite an event. But my dad had a great time discussion. Actually, the two of them, when I've seen Scotty Bowman over the years later on, the first question, how's your dad?
Very
He's
cool.
He has a formidable memory. Oh, yes. Very good. So that's the way that happened.
What did it feel like the first time that first blade hit the ice in the Montreal Forum?
I guess it probably... I had a wake-up call the first time I got off the train in Montreal. I was with Normie Ferguson, who later played with Minnesota. Normie and I were both playing in Montreal, and we had Brian O'Byrne. And Daryl Maxwell out of Truro was also there. Daryl didn't go back and stay, but we were all on the trip together with a scout from Prince Edward Island who was escorting us. He was being the dad figure. So the wake-up call was seeing all the amount of people in the Windsor Station. It was at it's called the Windsor Station where you arrived at that time. And that was it. But when we arrived to the Forum to put our equipment on, et cetera, and so forth, to try on and everything, your knees shook. I mean, you were walking into the Temple of Hockey. So the Montreal Forum. Something that you, as a youth, you saw that, but you never believed you would be there because it's not like a lot of people think. You didn't play hockey with a dream of playing international hockey. I didn't do that. I played hockey because that's what we did.
In the book, it was like taking me back to my childhood hockey days as a fan. You know, I mean, you're talking about names like Jacques Lemaire and then my idol, Yvan Cornoyer. These guys were all looking for a job same time you were.
Yes, well, you see, Jock had played in the Sheen the year before. Well, certain the guys that were there, Serge Savard, Carol Vadney, Germain Gagnon, Rogge Vachon. I could go on and on. Lemaire, Cormoyer. We could Jude Drouin, Christian Bordelot. It's just mind-boggling the number of players that were at camp and you became just part of the group. That's all. And when we see each other over the years, as time goes by, it's just like you fall back into the same. It's like you were together every day, because that's something hockey provides. But when you walk into the Montreal Forum and you saw Carry the Lamp, or you could see the pitchers, et cetera. The Forum was special, very special. Actually, when they closed the Forum, it was a sad day. It was kind of left a little tingling in the heart because it was an era of my life that was closing down.
For sure. Wasn't Rogge Vachon your roommate?
Rogge was my roommate in Thetford, yes. In his last year junior, he and I were roommates, Rogge. Those were the days when... You billeted with a family, and usually if you were like myself, if you were from Nova Scotia, well, you usually billeted with a French family. Over the years, I billeted with an Italian family in Montreal. I billeted with a French family, so I was able to adjust to the languages at that time.
You had also had a number of encounters with a number of Hall of Famers and people that a lot of us as hockey fans would remember. Tobe Blake was one of them. And Maurice Richard, that was a very touching part of the book.
Well, Tobe Blake was the first one who sort of mentioned to me about to make sure that I just didn't think if I didn't make it as a player that I could possibly have a probability of entering coaching. He said because the word, the way he had put it, the word was that I was directing traffic while I was playing on the ice surface. So he said, you seem to have a good eye for the game. Do not let anyone tell you you can't coach or you can't play. And that was fine. But the Rocket, yeah, he was special. In those days, it was Mr. Richard or Mr. Blake. The Rocket was president of our junior team at the same time. And I wasn't well, and he knew it somehow, and he sort of took a liking to me. And every once in a while, he'd go by and he would stop and ask me how I was doing. And he would slip a $2 bill. And those days, they had $2 bills. And he would give me a couple of dollars and put that in my pocket. And he'd tell me, you do not see anything. Keep being quiet. So I wouldn't say anything to anyone about it. A lot of people were surprised to see how he would always come and talk with me. When I would go to the forum, et cetera, he also... what was amazing about the Rocket was the fact that he was a lot more sensitive than a lot of people can believe. You see, because if you looked at him, he seemed to be very cold. And I was fearful of him because he had that stare and he seemed to be more of a person that you'd not approachable until completely different with me. Completely different. He was kind. He always took the time to talk to me, always took the time to make sure I was all right. And that was quite a, and he, one day he had told me, he said, I know. And I just sort of looked at him. He said, I know. And he said, how you feel? And I told him, well, it's not too well. I said, they keep saying that I have the flu or something. He said, you take care. He said, you have your breakfast? I said, well, I didn't eat today. I couldn't eat. And he said, you have to have something. So he made sure I had it, bacon and eggs, et cetera, and so forth that morning. But he would always check on me and always slip a couple of dollars. And in those days, the NHL players, if they were coming off the injury list, et cetera, would come and practice with us. So the Pocket Rocket Henri would come. And we wouldn't bother Henri as Henri Richard. Because Henri is very quiet. So we would sit there and get dressed. But he would tell us on the ice surface, he'd go out and play with us the same as he was playing in an NHL game. There was no, he didn't give you any quarter. But he also would direct traffic, et cetera, and so forth. And one day the Rocket told me, he said, you play with my brother. He said, you skate very well. I saw, and I was proud of that. And on our team, we had Guy Lapointe, for example. He was with me at that time. Guy never spoke a word of English. We used to have Jean-Claude Tremblay, Claude Provost, Gilles Tremblay. The players would come and practice with us. And I knew Jacques LaPerriere and all the other players anyways. The Rocket owned a tavern at that time also. I wasn't allowed to go. I wasn't of age. But my coach used to go there, Hervé Lalonde. But you would meet a lot of Gump Worsley, for example, was he was a nice person, always jovial. Jean Béliveau, that's where I met him. That's how we stayed friends right up to his death. Well, I believe that you're aware of that. We spoke at a couple of events together. I was also his honorary captain at his in Halifax, St. Mary's University, when he had his honorary doctor's degree presented to him, was there. So with him there, also John Béliveau, the reason why we didn't do hockey schools together, because he would say, Johnny, I can't do a hockey school with you. I'd like to work and help you with your hockey school, but if I do yours and I do not, I'd have to do others and I can't refuse others, so I won't be able to do yours. So he said, But any help I can give you, he said, just I'll give you some pictures or things like that. But you could call any player in those days, and they would call you back. John Béliveau would call everybody, but any player that you wanted to talk to, whether it be regardless of who. And I became close to Doug Harvey, of course. That story is in the book. And I used to sit with him later on when he was scouting at the end of his career. But there was a mind of hockey, very, very, very mindful. He had a problem with alcohol at the time, but he was a very nice person, an outstanding hockey player. probably one of the best I've ever seen. But the Rocket was the one who made the difference, I believe, when it comes to believing in what you can do. Because when the Rocket tells you, I know, and we know, a lot of people misunderstand. The Rocket did not have it that easy.
No.
When he was a player, they gave him a dusty time. And he suffered a lot of prejudice, and he didn't have much. He had to fight. He had to fight more. And he was fiery, so he was going to stand his ground, but a lot of insults. That's the way it was back then.
I'm glad you brought that up, too, because I wanted to ask if you thought maybe a soft spot he might have had for you is because he could relate to the prejudice, you know, even though, yours was as a black player and his was, of course, as a French player. So, I'd wondered if that was, the bond that really kind of tied the two of you together in that way.
I think so. I think part of it and the fact that he would say, you don't back up. He'd say, you don't back up. There's no backing up. And he would use us, and I'm looking, and I'm 5'5¼", so back then you're with the Rocket, I was 7 feet tall.
I'll bet. You're listening to Down Home Corner. I'm your host, displaced Campbelltonian Steve Bigeau. Visit our website, downhomecorner.com. Our latest shows and past podcasts are there. You can even drop us a line. We'd love to hear from you. Now, back to our show with John Paris Jr. He's from Windsor, Nova Scotia,
Now, another amazing encounter during that time, too, and it was a chance encounter and a chance, I guess, opportunity, was one night when you sat in with... You, I had to pinch myself when I actually confirmed this, but you sat in with Ray Charles. You did one set or something at Le Macambo in Montreal?
Le Macambo. I had no merit with that. I like music, and I would even go into Toronto, and they had the Macambo in Toronto, and they had the Macambo in Montreal, and they had the Esquire show bar and that, and they would let me in, and. I was very solid when it comes to chords, playing chords on keyboard. Well, of course, I'd taken lessons, and actually, I still play today, but more than chords. But I read music. But their keyboard man was ill, that's what they were saying. And of course, I had a couple of my friends. Well, John can play. No, John cannot play, I'm saying to myself. No.
Oh, so you were volunteered. I thought you volunteered. You were volunteered.
No. I was, no, exactly. Being smart, they were. And so finally, the guys that were with them, Ray Charles basically said, just give him the chords. You can play chords? I said, yeah, I can play chords. He said, well, come on, man. And just give him some chords. And he said, just follow. And so I played a set with Ray Charles, and there's really no merit to it. Like I said, it fell out of the sky like that. When you're playing, Ray Charles has a style all of his own, and it's all in tune. I mean, you do not miss a note if you're playing, because he would pick up on it. But I was amazed on how he could hear everything that was going on. But later on, I understood why. But they have a sequence. So once he gave me the sequence of 2-5-1, et cetera, you knew what to do. You played in a circle of fourths or circle of fifths. And I knew that. And with chords, it's easy once you, it's like anything. Anything's easy when you know it. When you do not know it, it's difficult. It seems more difficult. So I played that with him. And what amazed me was the way he could play those keys. He was a genius on the keyboard. He was a genius on it. I just had to play chords. So there was no problem there. And the intro to Georgia, I still play that today. But you see, Ray Charles will play a song. He'll play it one way, during one gig or one of his evenings where he's out, and he'll play it another way the next night. He's not going to play it the same way. It's how he feels.
So you
he's playing his feelings.
You were in the same boat as the rest of the band. You just didn't know it.
I just didn't know it. I can tell you one thing, though. I knew that what was amazing about all of that was that there were people there that had no idea that I was not a professional musician. So I must have faked it pretty well. You're sitting there, and if there was a song being played and I wasn't aware of the chords, they would call, bass player would call me. They would just call the chords or give me the sequence. And once I had the sequence, it was okay because you knew where it was going next. You just followed. You know, he said, we're starting, like if you were starting an A, you knew the number of sharps that you had in it. If you were playing in C, which a lot of people think it's easy, but there's more black notes that you have to play in key of C and blues, minor C, than there are is in most of the other keys. So unless you're playing F sharp, et cetera. But it was quite an experience.
They should have included that scene in the movie. Who would have played you?
Some dummy sitting in the stands.
Oh, come on, John, you're being hard on yourself. But let's get back to your career in hockey here. Now, after you knew that your career was probably going to end because of your health issues, or you were maybe letting go of it, almost organically you discovered coaching. Can you explain how that happened?
Well, when I was playing, I was always used to, even young, when I was playing minor hockey back home in Windsor, during the games or on the bench, I did a lot of directing of traffic, as we call it, because I was schooled by my dad that if you're playing the game, you're also coaching the game. That's the way I learned the game. That was the apprentice. So when I started playing hockey on the travel team in Windsor, well, heck, for me, I just kept doing what I'd learned at home, and I would play my shift, but I would also direct the traffic while I was out there and tell another player, well, move your feet, move left, get there, I'll move the puck to you. And or I'd say, I'm with you, I'd communicate. Called communication. What they call communication today is really coaching. You're coaching at the same time. So that's a huge part of why I went into coaching outside of the illness. Also, when I was playing junior, at the end of it, I'm in Sorel, Quebec, and Roger Lemoyne owned the team. And basically, I would help as an assistant coach. And I was attending college at the time and also doing all of the grunt jobs. For example, if there was a scouting assignment, his head scout would go out and watch these players and before trades, et cetera. Then I would be sent out incognito by Rodrigue to go and give my opinion on it, and I never knew why, but he stayed close to me until his death. So that's how I started out in the coaching, and then started coaching youth. But it came probably from my dad in the living room watching Hockey Night in Canada.
So it was the next logical step, I guess. Now, as a coach, you quickly gained a reputation as a player's coach, too, in a time that was not the norm. With you, players felt respect from their coach, and that always wasn't the case with coaches back in the day. Like, as for instance, you were against hazing. And in sports back in the day, it was considered normal or just boys being boys kind of thing.
Yes, there was no question there was going to be no hazing or anything like that. My academic background and my home education, that was against my ethics, against my morals. You didn't force anything or disrespect any other human being. That's just not the way I was brought up. And whether it be hockey or whether it be on the street or anywhere, even in my house, if you come into my house, you respect my house, I respect you, and you respect the people that are in it if there are other people there. So it was just natural for me to do that. They're human beings. We're all human beings. And rituals, no. Hazing, they would say it was a ritual at that time, and I would say no, there'll be no hazing. And I made sure as much as possible that there'd be none around me, at least to my knowledge. And if I did catch somebody that tried to do it, I'd get rid of them automatically. But it was I was known as kind of an outsider in that way, because most of the coaches would close their eyes and mouths to it and just walk away and pretend they were not aware of it. And that was not the way I was brought up. It's not my mindset. So hazing was out of the question. There's no way they were going to haze any player, especially what they do in hazing. It was unacceptable. Well, we've all heard the horror stories or seen it, or even what happened in other areas in the game as just a few years ago, maybe 10 years ago, decade ago. So It was bad, and it was accepted by many, just not accepted by John Parrish Jr.
That's very good. That's honorable, too. And then with a coach, it's a title you get for life. You know, you can coach somebody as a 20-year-old or a teenager, and then you can meet them 30 years later at a function or just even on the street, and they'll probably not refer to you as the first name. They'll say coach.
It's something you earn. It's not given to you. And I guess it goes with when you're coaching, if you've had a certain amount of success and you've had the fortune of being at the higher levels, and then I think they give you that respect factor of calling you coach. I'm not one who agrees with how it functions today, where a lot of the youth people, parents will coach a child in minor hockey, help out, and they call them coach. They're mentors and tutors. A coach is someone who runs his bench. He uses strategy and tactics, et cetera. He's tactical. It's a science within itself. But yet you're completely right on that. I'll meet people today that I haven't seen for 40 years. Hey, coach, how are you today? or somebody will send me an email. Or it's coach. Or the other day I was at a pregame skate, and when you have NHL players calling you Mr. Parrish a coach, then you know you're old, right? That's one thing I will give professional hockey players. Professional hockey players are very respectful. Very respectful. And they will call you coach or mister or sir. That's one thing that I will give the hockey world is different than the other sports. It's just that bond that's there. And if you can meet anybody involved in the game, regardless of where they're coaching or how good they are or how poor they've played, and you'll always have a common bond. When you meet them, it'll be just like you were together yesterday. You've never been apart 40 years. Maybe you just played against them. Maybe you just coached against them. There's always a common bond. And there's a camaraderie at the higher levels of coaching, which you do not find in minor hockey. It's starting to change, hopefully, where a lot of the coaches or players that have been at a certain level respect each other. There's no pretense. There's no jealousy. They exchange. I'll give you an example. When I was coaching in the pro level, against Hitchcock, et cetera, Hitchcock, Babcock, all of that group, Sutters, Bruce Boudreau, et cetera, and so forth, we all exchanged. I would ask a question about, well, what are you doing with your power play? One of them would ask, well, what are you doing in this situation? Or how did you handle this play? We just sit down and talk. We exchanged with each other our ideas, and we actually borrowed. We didn't steal. We borrowed from each other. We just exchanged. So it was known that you talked about the game and that you provided your thought process. Nobody had any given control or ownership of anything. Where in minor hockey, a lot of the coaches, and a lot of parents think that way, that there's an ownership to what, and there is none. And that's a growing and a learning process. And if I can leave a lot of the people who are listening with something solid and to never forget, is that ownership factor, there is none. And that everybody has one responsibility, is to always help the other coaches, the other players. You do not think that you have some kind of divine peril or a divine thought process that no one else has a right to. I learned that lesson very quickly.
There's a humbleness or a grassroots to the game of hockey that I think it permeates through all the levels. Here's what I noticed. When I went to minor hockey league games, you know, there's that community factor when I played as a kid. And then I grow up and I go to a game at Maple Leaf Gardens. And I remember I've taken my dad to an NHL game. And I remember back in the day, I used to still smoke, and you could smoke in the building back in the day, too. It tells you how long ago it was. But I remember looking around the building and showcases with trophies and things like that. It reminded me almost the same as Memorial Gardens, you know, back in Campbellton. And I could just, it felt as homey, or at least I felt as connected to it. Then when I got to get to see an NHL game at the press level and to speak with different people teams, players, coaches, that kind of thing. I was surprised at how they had time for me. You know, they treated me with respect, not knowing me. They were very courteous, and I didn't feel like there was a pecking order to it, you know? And I got to be honest, I've been to professional baseball games. I had a press pass to Montreal Expo games years ago, and I felt a different, you know, there was a certain hierarchy to it. But in hockey, there doesn't seem to be a pecking order. You could even refer to the commissioner as Gary, for instance, you know?
Yes. Well, the reasoning of that is very simple. It's because hockey, first of all, is the most difficult team sport to play that exists because you're on blades. Second of all, we all had the same start. You fall down before you can stand up on those skates. So everybody knows that. And at the same time, when you walk into an arena, there's a certain aura to it that you will find nowhere else. And that part of that aura, you understand exactly. For instance, when I was younger, the older boys were playing outdoors and then during the winter months and playing indoors at the indoor arena. I was doing the same thing. You had to play as a team to get along together. You were always together on the bus, your team meals. You depended upon each other. You helped each other. It was like a family, more like a family. Also, when you get to the coaching level and the playing level at the levels that are what I'd call elite, everyone knows you're like a fighter pilot. You know when you're going out. You do not know when you're coming back simply because you know your job. You're fighting for your job all the time. A lot of people do not understand that. Coaches all understand. They know. We all know you're hired to be fired. You know one day you're leaving. So there's another tightness of the group. We stick together. For example, if you see an NHL coach or a pro coach is let go, fired, he'll resurface either elsewhere as an assistant coach or as a scout, pro scout, because they take care of each other. That's the code. That's an unwritten law that we have. We take care of each other. And some just out of due to they feel disrespected, they'll leave the game. Where there's only 30 teams in the National Hockey League today, there's only 30 jobs that are open for head coaches. So you know as well as I do, there's a lot of coaches that you don't hear about anymore and that do not want to go back to junior or to the American Hockey League or to the minors, as we call it. But there's always someone that will offer you the opportunity to resurface. That'll go on and on. But that camaraderie is there. It's a tight-knit family. Hockey's very, very, very tight. People think it's a huge world. It's a very small world.
Now, in your coaching career, you eventually ended up coaching with the Atlanta Knights, and you were the first black professional coach or first black coach in professional hockey. And eventually you went on to win the championship. That had to be pretty gratifying and had to be feel pretty good, I would say.
Well, you know, Steve, I never really thought of it that way. Do not forget, Once they brought that to my attention, and then the research was done, well, I was always the first, regardless whether it was midget triple A, whether it was junior major hockey, I was the first black to coach midget triple A hockey. I was the first black GM executive in hockey, a GM head coach in major junior, in pro in Green Bay, in the American Hockey Association. So, but I'd never looked at it that way. I was a coach. I was a coach by choice and black by nature. That's the way I looked at it. I never put a pioneer title to that or a first to it. That had no importance to me at the time. I was coaching hockey. Media, if you're coaching in America, especially in the United States of America, you can go from being unknown on Monday to being on every major television network, major newspaper, media outlet in America the next morning and walk down the street on the Monday and nobody talking to you. And the next day, you're having trouble even being able to eat your breakfast at a restaurant where people are coming, oh, yeah, you're that guy. You're or I know you. And so that's... Again, I had no merit to that. That just happened to me. It was not done on purpose. I that's what we did. I played hockey with all of my friends when others couldn't play in other places. So in Windsor, I was able to play with my friends, right? That's what we did. So nobody told me that I couldn't play in Windsor. I received that outside later, but you're not supposed to be playing. Or when I said I would coach, you can't coach. No, they don't have black coaches. But I never put much importance on to that. I've always felt that you fall into situations. I'm religious. I do not hide it. I think we already have a tracing. It's all there, and it's up to you to grasp that. I had an opportunity that was presented to me. I grabbed it. I had no second thoughts in behind about being the first black hockey coach. I just wanted to be a coach. Just simple, the same as any. And when I looked across the ice surface, I saw another coach. I didn't see a white coach or a Russian coach or et cetera. Later on, when I coached against Bill Rowley when I was in Camilton, I knew, because I was older and I knew the importance of it, that two black coaches facing each other for historical values, et cetera, things like that. And I also, in Atlanta, when they had the parade and I saw people, white and black, that were crying, and then I understood the impact of it. It was then, because I knew that I had accomplished something with the help of others that had never been done before. So, that's when I had a good feeling.
I love you till there's no rain from the sky. I love you to the Amazon and Nile. They both run dry.
Saunders Brothers Show, and I'll love you till the Leafs win the Stanley Cup. Now that's a loaded promise, of course. Could go a couple of different ways. On the one hand, it could mean for a long, long time. On the other hand, it could be a limited time offer. Of course, if you debate it, then you lose the humorous impact. Take it as it is, so to speak. Well, take it as it is was pretty well the philosophy of us back in the 80s. I worked on air at CJCD in Yellowknife. Yes, Northwest Territories. It was there I became colleagues and later friends with Ed Saunders. Ed was our morning man and eventually our program director. Ed and I were radio 20-something-year-olds, eager to participate in station functions and community events.
We had a station softball team and in the winter, a volleyball team. Ed and I played on both those teams. And we were also caddies for a 90-something-year-old lady in Yellowknife's famous Midnight Golf Tournament. Ed even rode down Franklin Avenue, the town's main drag, on an elephant. An elephant in the Northwest Territories? Yes, those were fun days, both in radio and in my life. Ed and I lost track of each other after I moved away and lost touch until a couple of years ago when one discovered the other on Facebook. I found out that Ed had moved to Nova Scotia, and along with his brother Terry and their friend Brian, formed a musical act called The Saunders Brothers Show, kind of mobile kitchen parties for hire. Original music, comedy, audience participation, etc. I was glad to see that even though Ed Saunders was no longer in radio, he had taken that fun-loving spirit and transposed it into another career. Well, Ed Saunders from The Saunders Brothers Show, welcome to Down Home Corner. Thanks for being on the program.
Steve, it is a great pleasure to be with you. I'm jazzed to hear from you again. It's been a while, my friend.
To let the audience in on this, Ed and I worked together at CJCD in Yellowknife back in the mid-80s. And yep. It was a different time, right, Ed?
It was a different time and a different place, but a lot of fun and fond memories, though.
No kidding. And so you were telling me when people talk about, Nova Scotia winters are cold, you kind of stop them in their tracks, huh?
Yeah. What are you talking about? I lived in Yellowknife. I don't remember when you're up there in Yellowknife in the wintertime. I remember a mom telling her kids up there, you can't play street hockey when it's under minus 35. Minus 30, you're fine to play street hockey, but let's not be crazy, you know. I said, that's amazing. It's a unique place. I think everybody should go and spend 6 months up there anyway. It's just an absolute fun place to visit.
Oh, absolutely. It's the biggest small town you'll ever live in, for sure.
Yeah, well said.
Yeah, and I have fond memories of those days, and I never did get a chance to go back, and I sure would like to. We had a lot of fun back in the day.
Absolutely, yeah, we had some fun up there. I remember there was a circus there in town. I ended up that I had an elephant riding contest against one of the city councilors down the main drag. there's the midnight golf tournament in the middle of summer, the longest day that tees off at 12 midnight.
We were caddies in that, weren't we?
Yeah,
in
the
celebrity golf tournament or something.
Yep.
And they were stuck
absolutely.
And we were the celebrities.
Yeah, that's a hard update for celebrities.
It's a small town.
Yeah, no, it's a great place. Great place. You got to visit there. People should visit there. Absolutely.
Now, Ed, back in the day, you were musically inclined. I remember you had a guitar out, and we talked about music, and you were, you know, pretty talented, and we had fun with your songs and stuff. But I never knew that you would go on to a musical career. And you have recently formed the Saunders Brothers Show, and they've been popping up all over Nova Scotia. Now, just describe who the Saunders Brothers Show are.
Well, I came back to Nova Scotia after leaving radio in Ontario and came back to Nova Scotia, I guess about 2002. And my brother Terry and one of his friends, Brian, had been in a number of bands. And I had done just a little bit of solo stuff and done sort of a lot of in radio and some on stage, some comedy things. So we decided to put together a show that was a bit of an act that has as much comedy and interaction and audience participation as is possible. I mean, you know this, Steve, just from the people that you know and the people you've had on your show, how many great entertainers there are, how many great musicians there are throughout Atlantic Canada. Mm. So if you want to stand out up here, you have to not only have your musical chops together, but you also have to be able to bring a show that's a little bit different just to stand out. So that's what we did. So we try to have a lot of fun, and we get drag people up on stage, and they're wearing a silly hat and playing the spoons with this and the ugly stick and any sort of things, anything that we can do to have a little bit of fun. We can do a family friendly show or more of the naughty side of things, but whatever the audience likes, we like to have a lot of fun. That, I think that works.
Now, somebody described your show, and it may have been you, I'm not sure, I can't remember, but it was comedy kitchen parties. Do you think that's accurate?
Yeah, it has a lot of elements to that. It's sort of based on the East Coast, sort of sitting around the table kitchen party type thing. And that's my heritage, and that's so many people's heritage here. That playing some sort of musical instrument, just like you, Steve. Everybody on the East Coast, it seemed, played something when we were growing up. And it just we build that into it. As I say, we try to make it very audience friendly, so everybody can have a tambourine or a set of spoons or bang a drum or something like that. Anybody can make a noise, and it's all part of the musical fun, I think.
Well, and that certainly falls into the kitchen party theme, because that's what, you know, back in the day, there might not have been a full set of instruments. There might have been one guitar. How the spoons developed as an instrument is, hey, I can kind of keep a beat this way, you know, necessity is the mother of invention kind of thing. But there's definitely an East Coast flavor to your songs. You've done your third album now, was it?
Yeah, we have three albums out. Our first album came out, I believe, 2008, and that had, I think, mostly originals on there and a lot of sort of tongue-in-cheek fun things. Our second album had a bit of a gospel bent, but still East Coasty, and that was mostly originals. And our most recent album is called Singles. Came out a year and a half ago, and they're all originals on there. And the thing I'm really proud of in that album is that it has a lot of entertainers from the East Coast that have some degree of celebrity in their own way. Andy Palmiter, who is currently a CBC national host, appeared on there. Christine Campbell, a great blues singer, is on there, and a number of others. So we wanted to collaborate with this album, so every song on there has somebody from the East Coast, whether it be somebody from Symphony Nova Scotia or one of the Rankins doing or singing or playing something on there. So we had some good fun.
That's a coup to have one of the Rankins for sure.
Yeah, it was cool. Larry Rankin, now, he's not one of the sisters, he's one of the cousins. they're all the brood, they all sing together, so he helped us on the song that you actually have already played, Get Off Your Ass and Dance. He was one of the co-singers on there.
Yeah, we featured that song on a previous podcast.
Yes.
Now, for me, recording, I was really up for it. For some people, it can be an intimidating experience getting into a recording studio. I've always been fascinated by just everything about the record from, you know, back in the old days with the cork smell and everything. But I mean, having worked in radio, I had some experience behind a microphone, so it wasn't too intimidating for me, although it still could have been. How was it for you getting into work? What do you think of the recording experience overall?
I must say, I really didn't realize how much I would enjoy the recording experience. I absolutely love it. And it could be that we are very lucky that we work at Denmark and Denmark Productions. And Dennis Field is a producer who really, when you're working on the project, comes in as a collaborator. And, you know, you're not just going in there. He's not just a recording engineer that you're playing the songs for them. You're going through the songs and he's looking at, he'll be and put as much information in as you will let him. We'll play a song. We'll say we're thinking of having this kind of flavor with it or this kind of instrumentation. And he'd say, well, what about this or add this? How about if we move the bridge there? Why don't you rewrite that piece there? And he's a person that, I mean, he sits on the Juno panel nationally. He's won numerous ECMAs and Music Nova Scotia Awards and some Junos for his production work. So we really enjoy working with him. And he comes off as a real partner. And, I really, really enjoy the process of just patiently taking the song and instrument by instrument, playing it together. It really adds a flavor. And you really learn the song that you might have written, but you really learn it, I think, in the studio.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of people, because of budgets and different things, you know, do home recording, and that's great, but there's nothing like being in a studio with a professional and a good producer who can guide you through all of that, you know?
Absolutely, yeah.
You know, hopefully we'll see more recording in the Maritimes and Atlantic Canada, because as you said, it's just laden with talent, and that's the whole genesis of this show. I just knew there was so much out there that we can just keep finding it, you know?
Oh, yes, absolutely. You won't run out of people, for sure.
I'm Steve Bigeaud, and you're listening to Down Home Corner. We are all connected from Moncton to Mogadishu. Now, back to our show with Nova Scotia's Ed Saunders of the musical kitchen party, The Saunders Brothers Show.
Now, Ed, in your mid-50s, you say, I'm going to be a musician. I'm going to do this full-time now, and I'm going to give this a serious shot. A lot of people would say, yeah, mid-50s, you know, maybe a little old for this, Ed. The train's kind of passed you by. But when I heard that you did this, I almost stood up and cheered, you know, like, I mean, first and foremost, this is a friend of mine, but like to anybody who gives it a shot, you know, later in life, what made you not give up on it? And what made you decide to launch it at the young age of 55 or six or whatever?
Well, I always enjoyed music as a hobby. And as our albums started to sell a bit, the first two albums, and we said, I said, you know what, if I don't give it a full shot for at least a couple of years, just dedicated myself to it, I'm going to be one of those things I'm going to say, well, geez, I regret that. So I didn't want to say that. And yes, I was very aware of my age. I feel that age as I'm dragging the equipment around. So I get that. But you know what? For the kind of show that we do and the audience that we have, we're not trying to compete with the top 40 radio, and we're not going to get played on that way, and we don't expect that we will. We're trying to play to an audience that wants to have a good time, that don't take themselves too seriously, that we can make different kinds of connection with. And I think people see that in us. If we're putting on a reasonable show, if we can play and sing relatively well, and then emote the songs with some feeling and some fun and some connection, I don't see age as a real piece. And I mean, I haven't had that many people come up to me and said, "You old crazy old fill in the blank." I've enjoyed it. I mean, I right now at the present time, a couple of years of strength just focusing on it opened a lot of doors for us. This past summer, we played a lot of festivals. We were able to build up relationships with cities and towns and rec departments and people in the music industry. So I think it took some time to do that. And I don't know if people realize just how much work in the marketing. I know you and I have talked about this. The recording is one thing. The playing is another. It's the getting the gigs. It's the making the connection. It's the business side that really takes the time. So I wanted to make sure that if I didn't have a number one song, it won't be because I didn't try. So at least we get out there and work the radio stations, talk to people, shake hands, and get in front of people. And from a number of appearances over the last couple of years, I'm relatively happy. The last couple of years, we're averaging probably, well, I think we had 45 appearances over the summer this past year, and about the same the previous year. That's over the summer season. That's a busy time. So again, I'm happy with that. Three old guys dragging equipment around in a couple of trucks.
Do you get a lot of song ideas from people? Or do people ever pitch original songs to you at all?
We've had some people pitch original songs for us to do, and it's one of those things. I'm not saying we wouldn't do that. We do when we're playing live, we do some covers. But I'll be honest with you, if we're doing somebody else's song, we usually mess it up. So we'll slow it down or put a spoon in the middle of a part that was supposed to be electric guitar. We will mess around with it and have some fun with it. We do the old Celtic song, Rattlin' Bog. And in the middle of the breakdown, we do Queens, We Will Rock You, and then back into Rattling Bog. So that's what we do with Dorval songs. We have so many songs ourselves that and that's great. I've got my brother and I, Terry, write all the songs pretty well. And I don't think we'll ever run out of songs. I think we'll always have lots and lots of songs.
It reminds me of Stephen Wright, the comic.
Yes.
I remember years ago in an interview, they were asking him, you know, do people pitch you ideas or lines or here's a good joke? And he said, yeah, all the time. And he says, it's nice. And some of them are very funny. He says, but half of the buzz is writing it. He said, you know, and he said, it's like if I'm reading somebody else's joke, it kind of takes away a little bit of the fun.
Yeah. Right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You feel that way?
Oh, I agree with. Oh, absolutely. I would agree with that. I mean, as I say, we talk about the production process. When I think about, you know, perhaps sitting at the kitchen table and coming up with an idea of a song and then bouncing it off my brother and changing it and then taking it to the producer and and again, and then we're looking at it and taking it back, changing it again, bringing it up, practicing it, trying in front of a live audience, taking back, rewriting it again, taking it in, then recording it, then listening to it, then perhaps changing it, and then bringing in another artist maybe to play another line on it, and then master mixing and mastering. And by the time, you know, that it's, by the end of it, I say, hey, that's my damn song there.
That's always that's a good benchmark when you listen back to something and you say, gee, I like that. And you go, wait a minute, that's us.
That's right. Absolutely. Yeah. Well, you know that yourself from your songwriting too, Steve.
For me, I'm just blown away that I walk into a studio with an idea and I leave and I'm driving home and I'm listening to a demo of something that was just created. It just blows my mind.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. People ought to try it. If they have a song in there, they should go scratch it together, get somebody to give you a recording time or find a way to record it at home. But if you have an idea for a song, put it down. It doesn't have to be even amazing production. Just trying something and see what it sounds like. It is a buzz.
It's a great feeling of accomplishment. It's like the old adage, everybody has one good book in them. Well, maybe everybody's got one good song in them too, you know?
I think so too. I think that's well said, yeah.
Well, Ed, let's talk a little bit about a couple of your songs. Now, one we featured earlier in the show, I'll Love You Till the Leafs Win the Stanley Cup, and another one we'll play in just a couple of minutes from now. But tell us the story on this. Now, I'll Love You Till the Leafs Win the Stanley Cup. Now, I know you come from that honestly because you've been a Leafs fan ever since I've known you, and that goes back to the 80s. But tell us the story. Tell us the story about how the song came together and the story about the video, because that's pretty cool, too.
Well, the song, actually, it's pretty basic. A friend of mine was getting married, and he said, my fiance wants me to write my own vows. And he was terrified. He said, you're a writer. Why don't you help me? I said, you have yourself into it. You have to come up with something that you sincerely believe. You're not going to be able to remember it anyway. I said, well, what do you really believe in? He said, well, I believe in the Leafs. And I said, but they've lost since 1967. So I said, there you go. Say, I will love you until the Leafs win the Stanley Cup. And he said, I think I'll go with that. So I wasn't invited to the wedding. I don't know.
At least not.
But
on
anyway.
She's not on, he's not on her side of the family.
I don't know what happened. But anyway, apparently they're still married and it worked out all right. So that was good. And the Leafs still haven't won the Stanley Cup. But it's getting closer, so who knows?
Well, you know, that's interesting you say that, too, because, you know, the great thing about this show, Down Home Corner, it offers time travel. Now, here's... No, I know, you're laughing at me, but this is true, Ed. I've never lied to you much before.
Yeah, sure.
But anyway, okay, here we go. Now, you and I, as we record this, we don't know how this is going to come about here. We don't know the outcome of this series. And as we speak, the Leafs are actually ahead of the Washington Capitals 2-1 in their series. So who knows? They could go all the way and win the Stanley Cup. Now, the thing about our listeners, of course, they already know the answer. So the only two fools who don't know what's going on is you and me, which is kind of how we played radio back in the 80s, I remember. So... But anyway, so let's say the unthinkable happens. Let's say the Leafs do go all the way and win the Stanley Cup. What becomes of this song? What does this happen to this song now?
Well, I will say this, that I did hedge my bet, and ever so slightly, we released this song sort of as a joke to really get radio stations to play it for fun. But I didn't include it on our last album, just in case. Because if the Leafs ever did turn it around, then I wouldn't be burdened with singing those lyrics for the rest of all time for anybody who's crazy enough to buy our latest album. So I purposely didn't put it on the album, just in case.
Well, there's a reason for it to go viral right there, no matter what.
Yeah, that's
outcome,
right.
You
yeah.
know? I think that's great. I was going to ask you, how did you hedge your bets? You said, well, we took care of that. We didn't include it on any album. So there you go.
We didn't include it on the album. We try to get people to play it for a joke because what they did. So we appreciate that. Appreciate your spins too. But, you know, it's good fun. And that's what you have to have in music, my friend.
Well, it's a perfect song to have on this show because we have John Paris Jr. on there and all of his hockey history and as a coach and everything else. So, you know, it fits in pretty cool, I think. And John's a pretty cool guy, too. But the other song I want to ask you about is Weather Girl. Now, that's a pretty cute song. In fact, you even played it live for Weather Girls on TV. You sly old dog, you. But now let me ask you, was the song inspired by anyone in particular, or is it just poetic license, as they say?
A little poetic license, I guess. I mean, I thought about the fact that, I mean, I have been a guy for most of my life.
Have
and
you?
I know how many, yes, I have. I know how many stupid things that men can think when there's a pretty woman anywhere in the room. So I thought, you know, if a woman says anything at all that a man can turn into something suggestive in many ways at our basis, lowest genetic selves, Steve, you know that we'd say it. We're just polite when women are in the room. So I just extended that just a bit to say, you know, there's a guy who's sitting there watching TV and he's so lonely that when Alex Hayter or Cindy Day comes in and says, I'm going to have a warm front coming up, that he takes it the wrong way. So that's basically the story of the song. But I mean, I'm very pleased that we've been asked to appear on various TV shows and played on CTV and Global. And strange to me is that it was also one of the CBC Searchlight finalists last year for songwriting. So I can't believe CBC ever played it. But nonetheless, yeah, we've had some good fun with it.
You seem a little flabbergasted by your success with
it. Well, as I say, it's meant to be fairly lighthearted, and it has been. But now we've had some play in the States with it. A friend of mine who's a weather guy in Milwaukee, who another like you and I, an old radio warrior, he put it on his Fox News morning show. So
whoa.
We've had international play. We've been playing in Ireland and England, and I don't know. It's just sort of one of those goofy things. I don't know if it's the song I want to be famous for or not, but I'll take any love I can get, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's what John Dunsworth says, too, I think, about Trailer Park Boys. You know, I said, you know, you're playing a character, Mr. Leahy, that you're probably going to be remembered about for your entire career, you know? And you've done a lot of roles, because he's done a lot of things.
Yeah,
And I said, does that bother? He says, no. He says, it's okay, because in the end, it's all about the love, you know?
Yeah.
And I think your attitude towards your success of the song, I think, is a little bit of down-home humbleness. And I think that's pretty cool.
Well, we try to have good fun with it. So that's what it's about. And as long as the audience and the people we're playing for continue to come on out, well, that's what matters to me.
Well, there you go. And those two songs now can be part of your greatest hits tour. Now, your fans will know when they book you.
Well, we'll have to watch when the Leafs win the Stanley Cup and it's announced on the weather the next morning, we'll know that our job is complete.
We'll have a breaking news on downhomecorner.com. There you go, my friend. Thanks for doing this, Ed. Appreciate it always.
Thank you so much, Steve, for everything you do for music on the East Coast.
Newscast says there's where the girl whose love I've always sought turns my head all cloudy and my heart is in a knot. Tonight she even teased me that my weekend would be hot. I'm in love with the weather girl. She's on the air at 5 o'clock. It is my favorite hour. Smile, it is so radiant. It calls my fields to flower. Tonight she even teased me that by 10 we're in a shower. I'm in love with the weather girl. My lonely nights are over, skies are clear, and I'm surmising that all my days are sunny, things are bright on my horizon. All she does is smile and my temperature starts rising. 'Cause I'm in love with the weather girl. All you single fellas who are out there on the hunt, yourself a weather girl. I'm sorry to be blunt, but round about 11 she might show you her warm front. I'm in love with the weather girl. Hey, she was just
just mentioned that this weekend she's looking forward to 30 centimeters. I don't know if I can drop by that many times. My lonely nights are over, skies are clear, I'm surmising. All the days are sunny, things are bright on my horizon. All she does is smile and my temperature starts rising. Cause I'm in love with the weather girl. All you single fellas who are out there on the hunt, get yourself a weather girl. I'm sorry to be blunt, but round about 11 she might show you her warm front. I'm in love with the weather girl. Mentioned that later on in the newscast she's going to be showing us all of her hot spots. I'm looking forward to that. I'm in love with the weather girl. Yes, girl, I'm in love with the weather girl. She makes my toes curl. I'm in love with the weather girl. Oh, about 5 o'clock I'm going to be turning you on.
The Saunders Brothers Show and Weather Girl. I've always had a favorite memory of Ed. Now, to set the stage, it was Yellowknife, 1980s, before internet, call, display, and cell phones. We had a co-worker, Randy Bedard. He loved to play practical jokes. Well, Randy worked nights and Ed worked mornings. Back in the day, CBC TV used to carry Expos Baseball. It was delayed to time fit the time zone as you went west. So it started at, say, 8 o'clock in each time zone. That meant someone watching the beginning of a game in Vancouver at 8 o'clock. Well, if you were in the East, you may have already seen the game and be in bed and asleep if you lived in, say, Halifax. Well, Randy at the radio station was getting results in real time off the wire services, and Ed was at home rearranging his schedule and investing hours of time watching Expos Baseball in time delay. Well, Randy would wait till a long, exciting, but drawn-out game, one that went extra innings, sometimes hours long, and Randy, like a cat ready to pounce, would wait for the right game at just the right time, and he'd phone Ed. Well, Ed would naively answer the phone each time, and Randy would blurt out the score and spoil the ending for Ed. Well, Randy got him at least a half dozen times. Once, I remember poor Ed watching a 2.5-hour rain delay. The game never restarted. It was eventually actually canceled. And CBC TV, in their infinite wisdom, never replaced it with other programming in the Western time zones, even though they knew back east that the game was canceled. I remember talking with Ed the next morning about him wasting 2.5 hours watching a game that never actually began. One thing about us down-homers, we have such a colorful way of swearing, don't you think? And that's our show. Our thanks to John Paris Jr. His book, They Called Me Chocolate Rocket, available in Canada through Amazon.ca and in the States on BarnesandNoble.com. My thanks as well to Ed Saunders of the Saunders Brothers Show. You can check out the band at SaundersBrothersShow.com. Upcoming gigs, songs, albums, you can even book a show there. Down Home Corner is produced by Mike Sacchetta. Thank you, Mike, and me, Steve Bijou. Thanks for listening. Please share this episode on Facebook or other social media. And visit us at downhomecorner.com for all our shows. Drop us a line. Coming up on future webisodes, we'll get Camelton's mayor on to talk about Salmon Festival's 50th anniversary in 2017. And we'll get Rick Reese back on to talk about his new project, Gypsy Reese. They're going to be on the same bill as Willie Nelson at a jamboree in Alberta. And we've got so much more. It's East Coast culture, baby. For Down Home Corner, I'm Steve Bijou. And if you're a down-homer, we are all connected.